Bill Picardi here with the NPR News Update for Thursday, May 16. Today on the podcast, the State House passes a jobs bill, police in Grand Forks deploy drones, police in Minneapolis are slow to offer details of a violent encounter last week. We'll hear about the latest in the search for knowledge about the declining moose population, and we hear from a new literary talent from the Twin Cities. First, firefighters appear to be getting the upper hand on a wildfire that has destroyed several structures near the northwestern Minnesota town of Monaga. The Minnesota Interagency Fire Center says crews have dropped water on the fire from airplanes and helicopters, and they've built a bulldozer line around most of its perimeter. The Green Valley fire has burned about a dozen homes. Terry Berkman, who lives near Monaga, says his brother's home was destroyed.
I never thought his house would burn because it's steel-sided, steel roof, nothing closed. So I was surprised. I thought that would be one house that wouldn't burn, being it was all steel. But somehow coals got into the inside and just burnt it down. It's just a pile of scrap metal about 3 feet high, 3-4 feet high.
The size of the fire has grown to about 7,100 acres. It has burned a path about 8 miles long and 1.5 miles wide since igniting on Tuesday. Highway 71 has been reopened between Monaga and Park Rapids. Fires are also burning in northwestern Wisconsin, where authorities say at least 17 homes and dozens of other structures have been burned. The wildfire has consumed about 9,000 acres in Douglas and Bayfield counties. The former head of accounting accused of stealing more than $670,000 from the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis has pleaded guilty to theft and filing a false tax return. Here's Rupa Shenoy.
From February 1995 to January 2012, 51-year-old Scott Domeyer allegedly used Archdiocese money to pay credit card debt, personal expenses, and private school tuition for his children. Court documents say he also accepted first-class plane tickets from a vendor and diverted a check for Hurricane Katrina relief to pay for a car. Domeyer is scheduled for sentencing July 16th. The Ramsey County attorney says he faces up to 4 years in prison and will have to pay restitution. In a statement, the Archdiocese says insurance covered most of its financial losses and it has implemented, quote, several internal control enhancements.
Rupa Shenoy there. Cuts to production at two Chicago-area refineries are partly to blame for higher gas prices here in Minnesota. That's according to AAA's Gail Weinholzer. MinnesotaGasPrices.com says the national average for a gallon of gasoline is more than $3.60, but here in Minnesota, it's climbed above $4. Weinholzer says price hikes could continue into July.
Minnesota's in the top 10 states in the nation as far as prices are concerned. I would guess that would continue to climb over the next couple of days. We could end up in the region of perhaps Hawaii, California, Alaska, which are typically the three highest price states in the country.
The highest price for gas this morning at MinnesotaGasPrices.com was $4.35 a gallon. The conservative political nonprofit group Minnesota Majority says it is a victim of inappropriate IRS scrutiny. Mark Zedeklik has a look.
Minnesota Majority advocated for smaller government, the voter ID constitutional amendment, and several other issues. Its president, Dan McGrath, says the IRS contacted Minnesota Majority in March, seeking documents about its funding and activities. McGrath says, judging from the timing and the type of information the IRS sought, Minnesota Majority's accountant thinks the inquiry fits with extra scrutiny of conservative groups the IRS recently acknowledged. If that's the case, McGrath says the people responsible should be held accountable.
We're disgusted by it. We want something done about it.
On Tuesday, a member of the Rochester Tea Party Patriots said that group had also been targeted by what looked like extra IRS scrutiny. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A jobs and economic development budget bill goes before the Minnesota Senate today. The measure cuts the unemployment insurance tax for businesses, provides funding for job training, and spends taxpayer money to jumpstart business expansion in Minnesota. It's a big part of a plan at the state capitol this year designed to foster economic development in the state. Our Tom Scheck says other parts of the strategy provide generous financial incentives to specific companies.
This year's budget bills spent significant amounts of money to land or keep companies in Minnesota. There's money to help 3M expand in Maplewood, money to pay for the second phase of the Mall of America development, and money to help Rochester handle the Mayo Clinic's expansion. In addition, taxpayer funds are being used to encourage Baxter Healthcare to expand in Brooklyn Park and Emerson Technologies to set up shop in Shakopee. DFL Senate Tax Chair Rod Skoy of Clearbrook says he's hoping the incentives will help shape the state's future economy.
And you know, over the next number of decades, those are going to pay the state back many times over. So you invest in it today, get your payback over time. And that's kind of the philosophy that we've taken with this, and hopefully we're going to be successful.
The legislature typically tries to foster economic growth in Minnesota, but this year, lawmakers also have their eyes on a few major companies. It's partly coincidence because the Mayo Clinic, 3M, and the Mall of America all approach the state at the same time. But it's also intentional. Governor Dayton is a former commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and he hasn't been shy about using taxpayer money to encourage job creation. Katie Clark-Sieben, who is the current deed commissioner, says Minnesota doesn't spend as much as other states when it comes to incentives for companies. She says the latest round of taxpayer subsidies will help attract businesses to Minnesota, and she downplayed talk that it could create a rush of companies asking for a handout.
Ultimately, if we have fantastic companies like Baxter, 3M, knocking on the door of the state of Minnesota and saying, hey, we're interested in expanding here, we're interested in relocating here, that's a really good problem to have.
The jobs bill also includes $60 million in incentives to convince small, mid-size, and large companies to expand in Minnesota and hire Minnesota workers. DFL Representative Tim Mahoney, who chairs the House Jobs and Economic Development Committee, says companies sometimes overlook Minnesota's educated and productive workforce. He says the slate of incentives will prompt companies to give the state another look.
We're well thought of once we get a chance to tell our story. We don't win them all, no. But once we get a chance to be at the table, and that's what these incentives are, is it's kind of like playing poker. It's the ante to get in the poker game.
But others say it's counterproductive for Governor Dayton and the DFL-controlled legislature to give tax breaks to individual companies while raising taxes on existing businesses.
They absolutely are picking winners and losers with the tax code, which is really bad tax policy.
Republican Senator Julianne Ortman of Chanhassen is the former chair of the Senate Tax Committee. She says the Dayton administration and the DFL-controlled legislature should focus less on targeting one or two businesses and focus more on keeping taxes low for all businesses. Ortman also said the DFL plan will have other businesses paying higher taxes so companies like Baxter Healthcare can expand in Minnesota.
Because if a company has lobbying clout, they can come to the Capitol and get special treatment. And that makes it harder on every other taxpayer in the state of Minnesota. And our tax code ends up looking like Swiss cheese instead of predictable tax policy that's simple to understand, is transparent.
It isn't clear whether the incentives in these budget bills will actually convince companies to relocate or expand in Minnesota. If the strategy is successful, it may happen more often in the future.
Tom Scheck at the state capitol. The investigation continues into the deaths of two men and the wounding of two Minneapolis police officers. After nearly a week, there are just a few details of what happened in the shooting and the crash just blocks away from that shooting. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto released new information yesterday in an effort to show openness and transparency. But Brant Williams says some grieving relatives of the dead men want more information.
A flight of steep and narrow wooden stairs leads to the cramped basement laundry room in Jim Bickle's uptown Minneapolis home. This is where 22-year-old Terrence Franklin died from multiple gunshot wounds after police say he attacked a police dog and two officers.
So when they finally let us back into the house on Saturday, this area, there was blood on the floor and a little bit on some of the stuff that's around here. And
Bickle, who works as a producer for Minnesota Public Radio News, says last Friday afternoon he came home and found police officers conducting a manhunt in his neighborhood. However, he says officers didn't notice that his back door had been smashed. Bickle says he had to call over police officers who already started to search the next block. Then police started to pay a lot of attention to his house.
You know, while they were dealing with searching the house and whatever, the cops had this door open, and we could hear them yelling. At one point, my neighbor and I heard them yell, you're not getting out of there, something like that, to the guy.
So far, the official police account is that Franklin was a suspected burglar running from police. They say after being cornered in the basement, he fought with officers Michael Meath and Ricardo Murrow and grabbed one of their MP5 submachine guns. However, police say they still haven't determined who shot whom, nor will they say if Franklin had his own gun. Police Chief Janae Harto says the department is still waiting for forensic and ballistic test results, as well as statements from officers Meath and Murrow.
Well, we have two injured officers who are still recovering. We're on medication, and we need to make sure that they're in sound mind to be given a statement.
Harto provided more details into the collision between a squad car and motorcycle, which occurred several blocks away and about a half an hour after the shooting. According to the Hennepin County Medical Examiner, 24-year-old Ivan Romero Olivares died instantly after the collision. Police say Romero struck the rear of the squad car. A passenger on the motorcycle survived. Harto says the squad had its lights and sirens on as it drove through a red light at the intersection of 26th and Bladesdell Avenue. Harto says even though the investigation is not complete, she wanted to release this information in order to contradict public speculation that the officer was speeding.
It's out there. The squad's going 40 to 50 miles an hour through the intersection from people who are just standing on the corner. The reality of it is we use scientific data and GPS, and it says 16 to 17 miles an hour as he entered the intersection.
Harto says the department has asked the Minnesota State Patrol to conduct an accident reconstruction in addition to the police investigation. She says she's also open to the idea of asking for an independent probe into the shooting. Outside the uptown house where he died, friends and family members of Terrence Franklin have created a makeshift memorial next to the sidewalk. Several people sit solemnly nearby. Franklin's sister, Tamika O'Neill, says she doesn't believe police are telling the whole story.
We came out here, we've been out here every day, and some people walk up to us every day and talk to us. And a lot of people said that they believed that he wasn't armed. And a lot of people saying that they know that something was wrong with what happened.
Franklin's younger sister, Jasmine Mitchell, says she's also frustrated.
If they know what they did was the right thing, say it. Come out and do it. But they're not speaking. Everything that I'm reading articles, they're saying no comment to every question for journalists. No comment, no comment, no comment. Why are you having a press conference if you don't have any answers? What's taking so long?
Police Chief Janae Harto says she wants to provide answers and be as open and as transparent as possible. But she also says transparency does not mean immediacy.
That's Brant Williams in Minneapolis. Police in Grand Forks are now using small drones to help fight crime. The unmanned aircraft are small enough to fit in the trunk of a squad car. Police are working with the University of North Dakota to test law enforcement uses for small unmanned aircraft. Here's Dan Gunderson.
A handful of people gather in the locker room at the University of North Dakota football stadium. They're waiting for an early morning rain shower to pass so they can test a small four-rotor helicopter. It can't fly in strong winds or heavy rain. The Federal Aviation Administration has granted a special permit for the Grand Forks Sheriff's Department and the University of North Dakota to fly drones in 16 counties. UND is also training other law enforcement agencies to use the drones. Al Frazier is a Grand Forks deputy sheriff and assistant aviation professor at the University of North Dakota. Frazier explains today's training scenario. A stolen vehicle being pursued by Grand Forks police crashed near the university football stadium.
By the time the patrol unit got here, he saw him going over the fence and into the main stadium football field area here. And we believe that he's somewhere in the stadium. Then he's a felon suspect, unknown if he's armed.
As the clouds pass, the crew snaps together the 3-foot-long, 5-pound helicopter. It's flown by controls on a tablet-like device that also shows a live video feed from the drone's onboard cameras. Al Frazier says this is nothing like the high-tech unmanned aircraft flown by the military and the Border Patrol.
You can buy better cameras at Best Buy, you know, off the shelf. So we're not utilizing whiz-bang, you know, Flash Gordon type of technology. It's off-the-shelf technology. We're just employing it from an aircraft that is able to get us a couple of hundred feet up in the air where we get that different perspective on the incident.
This helicopter carries a video camera and an infrared camera that shows objects based on temperature. It doesn't take long to find the suspect hiding in a corner of the stadium. Grand Forks Police Officer Tim Hsu says if this search were real, the unmanned aircraft, or UAS, would save time and protect officers.
Without the UAS, we would have had to slow search this entire field, exposing officers to potential danger. Whereas here, we've confined them to a small area, and now we can approach a smaller area with less officers, with less exposure.
Officer Hsu is trained to fly small unmanned aircraft. So far, the small helicopter has been used in only one real incident, the search for a drowning victim. But Hsu expects the demand to increase as police officers and firefighters become aware of what the drone can do. He says the primary uses will be searching for missing persons or fleeing suspects or taking crime scene photos. Hsu says officers will be cautious about how the drones are used. He says if a police officer can't look somewhere without a warrant, the drone won't be allowed to either. The Supreme Court has ruled if a police officer riding in an airplane sees criminal activity, it's admissible in court. The use of drones hasn't been tested in court. A university committee made up of professors, law enforcement, and community members will monitor the use of drones in this research project. But Hsu doesn't expect to run afoul of Fourth Amendment privacy protections.
You know, because really, nothing's really changing in law enforcement. We still have all of the same privacy issues, you know, Fourth Amendment issues that we still have to follow. So this doesn't really change that. It just simply changes the perspective on which we look at something.
Public perception is an issue project manager Al Frazier knows is important if small drones are to become a useful tool for law enforcement. He says the university and the sheriff's department are committed to being transparent and taking input from the public.
I think it's almost an unwarranted fear that the public has that we're going to be peeking in their windows. And I'm not aware of an unmanned aircraft mission in the nation yet that has resulted in that kind of evidence. They've all been public safety, humanitarian type missions. And that's really where I think the strength of this technology is.
Al Frazier will take the small aircraft on the road this summer, doing show and tell for police and emergency responders in 16 eastern North Dakota counties where the FAA allows the aircraft to fly. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Grand Forks.
On the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. The Minnesota DNR has started the second phase of its ambitious study to determine why the state's moose population is declining so rapidly. This past winter, researchers fitted more than 100 adult moose with high-tech GPS collars to track their movements. And Dan Crocker says last week they began a pioneering effort to track newborn moose calves.
For the past week, a crew of wildlife handlers based in Alaska has flown a helicopter into the wilderness surrounding Ely, tracking adult female moose. A couple days after a cow gives birth, explains DNR biologist Glenn Delgides, the wildlife handlers swoop in and put collars on the newborns.
Most of the time, they're able to just walk up to the calves. They're anywhere from 2 to maybe 4 or 5 days old, and they're pretty stationary still. They don't move around much yet. You know, and they slip an expandable collar on them, and GPS collar, ear tags, take a rectal temperature, body weight, and they're pretty much done within about 5 minutes.
So far, they've collared 25 calves, halfway to their goal of 50. But 3 calves have also died, one shortly after being collared and 2 after being abandoned by their mothers. In the adult study, 4 died after being collared. Delgides says that's a risk researchers are willing to take to protect the population as a whole.
Some people might say, well, let nature take its course and you know, you shouldn't interfere. But you know, if we do that in the case of our moose population in northeastern Minnesota, there's a very good chance they'll be gone in about 20 years.
The collars allow researchers to track the moose on computers, where they see a precise location every hour. It's the first time moose calves have ever been fitted with GPS collars. The goal, says Delgides, is to quickly respond when a collar signals an animal is dying to find out why.
When that collar kicks into mortality mode, and that happens when the calf is not moving very much, it sends us a text message and an email. And then, very similar to the adult study, we can mobilize our team to go into the field and investigate and get that carcass, hopefully, before it's scavenged or decomposed.
And then either perform a necropsy on the spot or transport it to a University of Minnesota lab for analysis. The moose population in northeast Minnesota has crashed by 2/3 since 2006 to fewer than 3,000 animals this year. That follows a similar decline in the northwest part of the state in the 1990s. Research has linked the drop to warming temperatures, but it's still unclear exactly what is killing the moose at such high rates and their calves. Ron Moen, a biologist at the University of Minnesota Duluth, says it's normal for about half of moose calves to die in their first year. But he says recently, between 60 and 80% haven't made it through their first winter.
And it kind of puts them right at the tipping point where, you know, we need to understand what's going on with the calves, because the calves are the future moose in the population. You need to have them survive.
The DNR's Glenn Delgity says the new calf study, even though it's only a week old, has already revealed surprises.
We had a female that moved off 3 to 4 kilometers from its calf after it was handled. She was gone for a couple of days. We were watching her on the computer, and we thought, oh boy, this is going to be an abandonment.
But the next morning, he checked his computer, and she was back with her calf.
And they've been together since, and they're doing just fine. So, you know, you never know. We're learning things about their calving behavior and movements that most biologists in North America don't know because they haven't had the technology.
Delgadis also says they've been surprised by the number of twins. So far, 2 out of every 3 pregnancies have produced twins. That's triple the expected rate. And the calves have weighed more than anticipated. It's too early to know whether those surprises bode well for the species. Researchers hope to finish collaring calves this weekend. Then they'll monitor their computers throughout the summer as they continue to try to unravel the mystery of Minnesota's disappearing moose.
Dan Crocker in Duluth. Now we close out the podcast hearing about a Twin Cities writer who's getting attention from the critics. Twin Cities author Ethan Rutherford's tales range from the voyage of a Confederate submarine to a science fiction saga about hunting for whales in the middle of the desert. All of the short stories in his debut collection, The Peripatetic Coffin, involve journeys, and they seldom end very well. Here's Ewan Kerr.
The Peripatetic Coffin is an eye-catching book title, and as Ethan Rutherford admits, somewhat provocative.
I get a lot of flack for that title. People are like, oh, so fancy, $10 word here.
But it's fun to say.
It's fun to say.
It's really fun to say.
Well, it's like one of those words, and then suddenly you see it everywhere.
The title comes from the first story in the collection, which is about the H.L. Hunley, the submarine commissioned by the Confederate States during the Civil War in an attempt to break the Union blockade of Charleston. Rutherford came across the so-called fish boat, as it was known, when he lived in Charleston, where the boat is now preserved.
And it's tiny. I mean, it really is this thing that just is cobbled together. And I read the plaque, and I found myself thinking, you know, who in their right mind would ever, ever, ever get aboard a ship like this?
A crew member nicknamed the Hunley the Peripatetic Coffin. 2 complete crews of 8 men died during test runs. Rutherford decided to write about the 3rd crew, which volunteered despite this dismal record. He says, as a fiction writer, he goes to wherever makes him feel uncomfortable.
I'm interested in the characters who do the things that I would never, you know, in 100 years, do. And in some ways, that's what makes writing interesting for me, is plunging yourself into that sort of scenario and writing your way out of it.
Rutherford placed himself in the mind of real-life crew member Ward Lumpkin, who knows the situation is desperate.
Conventional wisdom around Battery Marshall has a survival rate aboard the Hunley hovering near zero, and that's without ever having engaged an enemy ship. Cannon probability, Augustus calls it. As in, stuff yourself inside a cannon and see what happens. But there's probability and there's certainty. Antietam was a washout. Gettysburg was worse. Crescent City folded like the house of cards it was, and we lost the Mississippi.
Ethan Rutherford is multifaceted. He's taught writing at McAllister College and plays guitar with the local band Penny Royal. There is also a remarkable diversity in Rutherford's writing. In The Peripatetic Coffin, readers will find a domestic drama involving a couple regretting their decision to raise alpacas, a story about sailors whose ship is trapped in Arctic ice, a hilarious description of a summer camp director who decides the easy way to solve his problems is to declare war on another camp across the lake. Finally, there's a science fiction piece set in the future about hunting durwals, huge worms swimming through the sand of a planet where the water is long gone. Ethan Rutherford says in each of them, he's seeking one thing.
You're trying to find the one moment in your character's life where everything changes. I mean, that's the moment that you're interested in as a short story writer.
Rutherford says whenever short story writers admit to their craft in public, the almost inevitable follow-up question is, so, when are you doing a novel? He's writing one now, but doesn't sound entirely convinced he'll finish.
I mean, I may get about 30 pages further into it and say, you know what, maybe this makes a really good short story and leave it like that.
It's not that he's opposed to novels. He's reading tonight at the Barnes & Noble in Edina with Northfield novelist Ben Percy. Rutherford just prefers the shorter form. He likes them because of the freedom it gives him as a writer.
You can say, let's write a short story and we're going to make it science fiction and I'm going to spend 4 months living in this sort of science fiction universe, knowing that I'm going to wrap it up and then I can go off onto the next thing.
He also likes short stories as a reader.
I feel like short stories are more gut punches. You read a short story and you stop and I feel like you sort of have to put it down and take a couple of breaths. And I like the gut punch that a short story offers you.
Including gut punches thrown from a peripatetic coffin of a cobbled-together submarine under the waters of Charleston Harbor. Gosh, that word is fun to say.
Ewan Kerr finishes off the NPR News Update for Thursday, May 16th. The Friday roundup of news right here tomorrow. I'm Phil Picardi. Thanks for stopping by.